Good morning.
Good morning.
The Allen matter. Good morning, Mr. Brennus.
Good morning.
Do you want to reserve 3 minutes?
Yes, that'd be fine. Thank you.
Did you receive the communication about addressing what the effect is of the release date, which is, appears to be March 2015? Can you tell us where Mr. Allen is?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. And just for the record, this is Casey Granis representing Alfonzie Allen on appeal. Mr. Allen has been discharged from his 1077 commitment. He lives in the community now.
Okay.
The issue here is whether due process.
Does that appeal render the appeal moot?
Technically moot, yes. And we ask that this court reach the merits of the issue anyway, because it presents an issue of continuing and substantial public importance. I can go ahead and address that further if the court would like, or I could reach and go right for the merits of the argument.
I think you might profit from explaining why we should reach the merits.
Very good, Your Honor. There's three factors involved to reaching the merits of an argument that is moot. One is whether it's public and private in nature. Two, whether the issue is likely to reoccur. Three, whether the lower courts and future litigants will derive benefit from guidance on the issue. And all three factors are present here in this case. In fact, we have it from the trial judge himself in this case, encouraging Mr. Allen to take this issue up on appeal, because it is an issue of first impression, and having a holding from the appellate court on which way to go would be beneficial to the lower court. And also public or private nature, and whether the issue is likely to reoccur. In this case, those two factors are intertwined. And I say that because in the NGRI context, quite a few folks are indigent. They will not be able to bail out for their pretrial jail time, and therefore the issue is likely to reoccur, because again, there will always be this issue of, okay, that class of people, are they entitled to credit for time served?
What I'm struggling with. If it's so that it's a case of first impression, and if it's so that these statutes have been in place for quite some time, is the reason that it has not yet been resolved because for some reason it constantly escapes review, or is the reason just that this is an apparent circumstance making it not likely to recur?
The reason is that the issue hasn't been argued before, even though it could have been. Because I don't think it's come to surprise as anybody in this room today that a good number of insanity acquittees are poor, and that they will be unable to bail out before that insanity adjudication takes place. And as long as that is an empirical fact, that I do not believe is in dispute.
Well, no, but the second part of that is, and they stay in the commitment status to a point where this claim becomes right.
That is correct.
That's the second part of it. And that's what I'm wondering. Is it a situation where that claim doesn't happen very often, or is it a situation that for some reason it happens all the time, but it's just escaped review?
I don't believe it happens all the time. I mean, certainly there are acquittees who are able to.
In these different Title 10 circumstances where people are, you know, we get the short-term commitments, and those escape review because the time limits expire.
Right, 7105.
Yeah, before cases. People can. Right. Yeah, right. I said it wrong. And so I understand how those escape review. I'm trying to figure out how, if it's so that people are staying in a commitment status for the length of the maximum penalty of a Class B felony, why it would be that it's a case of first impression. Those are the things that don't link up.
Or a Class C felony.
Class C
felony.
Yes, I
get your point.
Yeah.
You know, really, Your Honor, the best. I don't have the research. I don't have the statistics to back up what I'm about to say.
But I'm looking for your best guess because that's the best. That's all I'm doing right now.
My sense is that it's not unusual for acquittees to have to serve their entire statutory maximum on the 1077 commitment. Certainly not all of them, but enough that makes this issue worthwhile to reach the merits of. And perhaps Ms. Bulger would have a better sense of what we're talking about. I'm sure she'll have something to say about that. But again, I go back to the basic point, though. Okay, we got two basic factors at play here. Poor acquittees who were then held up through, for a commitment term to a point where this credit for time served issue actually makes it relevant, makes sense. And certainly, Mr. Allen's not going to be the only one. And, the issue hasn't been raised before. It's being raised now. And, it's an interesting issue. Mm-hmm. And, again, I think the trial judge hit it on the head, which is, hey, we need some help with this here. The trial judge, who certainly had more experience than, say, I would in terms of how often this issue would come up, believed that
very rarely.
Very rarely?
But you have about 41.
I know. I've spent this whole time talking about trying to get this court to review the merits of the issue. I'm sensing that perhaps that's not going to happen, but I will continue to try to convince this court otherwise, and I will, in my rebuttal time, I'll try to touch on the merits of this issue.
Let me ask you to think about, in your rebuttal time, addressing what's the impact of a conditional release. So if someone's working their way toward the max, but they get a conditional release, does that, the underpinnings of this argument go away, they're out in the community, or does it still remain for consideration?
I can go ahead and try to answer that now, Your Honor. Go into my rebuttal time a little bit. If I understand your question correctly, the idea is that, if an acquittee is not actually locked up in the hospital the whole time, but gets on conditional release for at least some period of that civil commitment term, how does it affect the credit for time served argument? And the argument still holds, is the answer. And the reason it still holds is because when we're talking about which classes of acquittees are being compared here, it's the ones who are able to bail out versus the ones who are not able to bail out. Both of those are entitled to credit for time served during their commitment term, and that includes both being locked up in the hospital and being on conditional release in the community. Liberty is still being impacted on conditional release, but yes, they're in the community. But the point is that both of those classes are entitled to that credit for time served as a matter of legislative authority. We still have the question, though, of, going back to when the poor acquittee is locked up pretrial, which is definitely, the absolute curtailment of liberty, whether that needs to be taken into account
when determining. They're not an acquittee at that point.
Not at that point, Your Honor, but they will be soon.
But you keep calling them an acquittee. They're not an acquittee.
It's just shorthand, Your Honor. I understand that they're not an acquittee at that point. But instead of eating into more of my rebuttal time, I'll follow up on that point in a few.
Respond to any question. I don't know if you...
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Allison Bogar on behalf of the State and the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. In this case, this court should affirm the trial court's ruling by denying Mr. Allen's credit for time served pending his not guilty by reason of insanity acquittal. Because
are you going to address the
motion? I will, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And while the issue is technically moot, and the question about what happens, why has this not come up before? I only know of one case prior to Mr. Allen's case. It wasn't a King County case. And I believe it was cited in the briefing to the trial court. But I believe the reason why it does not come up is because of the fact that the defendant is acquitted of the crime. And based on the statutory construction of 1077, it's clear that an individual is acquitted and they are committed, civilly committed, for treatment of a mental illness. And that commitment is an order for either inpatient or a less restrictive alternative for the patient's treatment. And in contrast with that to a criminal defendant, if they are not acquitted, they're found guilty, they're convicted, they are sentenced, and they are incarcerated either in a prison or a jail, and that's not treatment, although some mental health treatment could be provided there.
He was given 85 days credit.
And he was given 85 days credit.
For the mental health treatment he
that's
got.
Correct.
Pre-adjudication.
Exactly. Okay. And so based on the statutory construction of 1077, it's clear that pre-commitment incarceration should not be credited towards the maximum term of commitment for inpatient or less restrictive treatment for a mental illness. The whole point and purpose of 1077, once an individual has been found mentally ill or not guilty by reason of insanity, is because they are both mentally ill and dangerous.
Well, what's the frequency of people remaining committed through the number of months that would be the maximum for a Class C felony or a Class B felony or whatever? What's the ballpark figure for those people that don't get better and get out of being committed before they reach that point?
Actually, I'm glad you asked me that question. I've been handling all of the not guilty for reason of insanity cases for King County since 2009, 2010. And we have approximately 150 cases that are still that they're still monitoring them, individuals on a conditional release, or that they've been found not guilty and we're still within the maximum term of commitment. There are a lot of individuals who were civilly committed in the 70s and 80s who, for a Class A felony, which is lifetime, and they're still on it. We're still monitoring those. We have had, I've filed several cases a year for a motion for a discharge based on the expiration of the maximum term of commitment. I don't have a percentage, but it's more than, in my experience, I think at this point in time, I've at least filed 15 dismissals of King County cases based on the fact that we've reached the maximum term of commitment. And I just received one. It was a Class B felony. It was just last month. An individual named Mr. Hopwood, who was civilly committed, and he was in the hospital up until about 3 months before his civil commitment term expired, and he was on a conditional release for the first until the actual expiration. So it does happen. It's not unusual. And in this case, and I will point out, in this case, Mr. Allen did receive conditional releases. I mean, there's a lot of due process built into 1077. So if he was no longer mentally ill and dangerous, the state would have dismissed his case. But in Mr. Allen's case, he had a conditional release. He blew it. It was revoked. He petitioned for conditional releases twice following his revocation. Both times denied, both times he appealed it to this court, and then he had a full-blown jury trial for a final discharge, and I handled that in the trial court. And the jury unanimously said he wasn't fit to be released, and then Mr. Allen appealed that as well.
Do you see a need for guidance in this area, or are you arguing for or against mootness?
If I'm arguing, well, I know it's technically moot. I should say if the court is deciding in my favor, then there is need for guidance.
I think we cut those kind of deals.
I know. I think given the statutory language, I think given the case, I believe it was in I don't remember which county it was now. That one seemed, the decision that was rendered there, that was part of the trial court decision, really made no sense. I mean, there wasn't even a statutory construction argument made in that other case. And here, when you follow the statutory construction, looking even at the guidelines from other cases or other jurisdictions that have the same type of civil commitment statute that we do, it's clear on reading those that unless it's provided for statutorily, it's not. It doesn't make any sense to provide for pre-incarceration or pre-acquittal credit for time served. And I will point out that in this case, if the court were to grant a pre-commitment credit for time served, it would actually create an equal protection violation. Because if, for example, there was two individuals, Mr. Allen that we have now and Mr. Allen who had some money, who could post bail, the first thing is bail is individualized to the defendant, and after being charged with a crime, then we look at the dangerousness and the ability to flee or not show up for court next time, failure to appear. Somebody who had more money than Mr. Allen, maybe there would be an issue for whether or not they're actually going to be able to flee the jurisdiction or show up. And so aside from the bail issue, assuming for right now they were able to make bail, you have two individuals who are actually same crime, same criminal history, same date of civil commitment. Mr. Allen and this individual stay to the maximum term of commitment. Both of them stay in the hospital for that amount of time. The individual who had wealth enough to bail out of jail, pre-commitment, it gets a full 10 years of inpatient mental health treatment. Mr. Allen, if he gets our Mr. Allen here, if he gets credit for time served for those 2 years, pre-acquittal, he only gets 8 years of inpatient hospitalization treatment for his mental illness. Now, there is an equal protection argument because he's not getting as much treatment as the wealthy individual. And because we know that a jail is not a hospital, it is not a commitment facility for inpatient treatment. So he's not getting the kind of treatment and the kind of structure that is provided in 1077 when you are committed. He couldn't be, he couldn't get a conditional release while he was sitting in jail. And he couldn't get an evaluation so that, you know, he could not be dismissed or the case could be dismissed instantly. It was at the time that he pled not guilty by reason of insanity. And I do want to point out, too, that when we're dealing with these cases, it's the defendant who pleads and proves his own insanity. This is not somebody who has that forced on them. And this is not I know there's some jurisdictions that have a guilty but mentally ill statute, and maybe under those circumstances that would apply. But in these circumstances, when it's a not guilty by reason of insanity, it cannot apply because it circumvents the purpose and the need for mental health treatment for individuals who have proven themselves dangerous. And under the Constitution of the United States, we have the ability to treat individuals such as these differently because their needs are different. And once that they are found to be not in need of inpatient treatment under the due process standards, they can either be conditionally released or discharged earlier and not even meet their maximum term of commitment. And we have those cases a lot as well. We have individuals who have been on a conditional release for 10 years. And I know of one case of a woman who was set her apartment on fire. She was charged with arson. And we, after 5 or 6 years, she was no longer mentally ill. And so we dismissed the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think I have anything more to say about the mootness issue, except that if I can find some stats on it, I'll forward them to the court. Turning to the merits of the argument, you know, the gist of Mr. Allen's argument is that loss of liberty is loss of liberty, whether you're in a jail cell or in a padded cell, so to speak. And if the state's going to take away a person's liberty, that needs to be accounted for in some way. And when you have a situation, when you've got what ends up being a poor acquittee and the rich acquittee being held in civil commitment up to their statutory maximum time, then you've got a situation where the poor overall is being has a longer duration of loss or liberty than the rich person. And that's what creates this disparity that has constitutional consequences here. Now, I get the gist of the state's argument that the civil commitment scheme is serving a different purpose than the scheme under the Sentencing Reform Act, or rather the criminal scheme. I get that. But it should be pointed out that the purposes of holding a person in a jail cell pending an insanity adjudication versus the purposes of the civil commitment, they do overlap. And they overlap in the sense that in both situations, the community is being protected from the person who is being detained, who's lost his liberty. And so in other words, society is deriving a benefit from the situation where a poor person is being held in jail pending the insanity adjudication. It's not as if there's some sort of windfall going on here. Again, overall, there's this disparity. At the end of the day, you know, there's the disparity in wealth that's creating a problem in the treatment of those two classes of individuals, and the credit for time served for jail time is the way to remedy that. Thank you.